Okay, hello friends, Chag Sameach, and welcome to a new two-part series. This series, titled Teshuvot Ovar Chachamim, we'll explore, which I'm very excited for, will be led by our beloved Rav Yosef Zernigan, and we'll explore three Teshuvot of Sephardi Chachamim. About our speaker, Rav Yosef Zernigan is the assistant rabbi of the Spanish and Portuguese Kahal Kadosh Mikveh Israel in Philadelphia, USA. He was born and raised in Great Neck, New York. Prior to graduating from Queens College with a degree in economics, he pursued the rabbinic path of his great-grandfather, Mola Yosef Dilmani, by studying under Rabbi Chaim Sabato and Rabbi Nachum E. Rabinovitz, Zichrono Livracha. Rabbi Zernigan subsequently received semicha from Rabbi Sam Kassin and Rabbi Yaakov Peretz of this Shehebar Sephardic Center in Jerusalem. He serves his country as a chaplain in the U.S. Air Force Reserve and also works as a translator of medieval Sephardic Jewish texts for the Shehakol Project. Fortunately for us, Rabbi Zernigan is no stranger to the Chabura, and I highly recommend all to check out his previous shiurim available on our website. With that said, thank you everyone for being here live, and for all those who will be watching later, and thank you so much, Chacham. The floor is yours.
All right. Hanukkah Sameach, everyone. I want to apologize in advance. I have a little bit of a cold, so my voice is not as strong as it normally is, but very briefly, the topic for today, or for some of you tonight, that I want to focus on is a very important teshuvah, in my opinion, by Rabbi Shmuel de Modena. A little bit about this Chacham, because he is one of the most towering figures in our tradition among Sephardim, and actually Ashkenazim alike, but his teshuvot are not widely studied in the degree that they ought to be. And there are a number of reasons for that, but I think it's appropriate that we focus a little bit about the life of the Chacham, and I'll briefly address what we're going to study today. Rabbi Shmuel de Modena was part of the generation of the post-Gerush. His teachers were both Gerushim from Portugal, from Spain and Portugal. He learned under two primary Sephardi Chachamim in Greece. The first being Rabbi Levi ibn Habib. Ibn Habib was one of the protagonists in the famous Semicha controversy between the teacher of Maran, Rabbi Yosef Karo, Rabbi Yaakov Berab, and between himself regarding reinstituting the authentic semicha, the ordination that would place Dayanim on a Sanhedrin. And his other teacher was a lesser-known chacham, Rabbi Yosef Taitai Tzaks. His teshuvot were lost to history until modern times, where a smattering of his teshuvot were compiled by professor in Israel whose name escapes me at the moment. At any rate, he was a towering figure. His teshuvot, which were published by his son, span all areas of halakha. That is, all four sections, kol arba chilkei shulchan aruch, all four sections of Rabbi Yosef Karo's shulchan aruch, and they address issues in an uncompromising and unapologetic way. What I mean by that is he was not afraid of deviating from the status quo when his hakira, when his derisha, when his analysis lent itself to a different conclusion. Just to give you an idea of what I mean by this, Maharashdam was one of the few Sephardi poskim of his time that endorsed this now well-accepted notion of there being no Reshut HaRabim nowadays, really. No public domain for the purposes of Shabbat. Now, you can agree with him, you can disagree with him. This shiur is not about Eruvim. But he was one of the first to endorse this position unequivocally, which was a matter of contention among the Sephardi Rishonim and well into his lifetime in the 16th century. He's also very famous for his position on the status of Kohanim nowadays, where he held, as a matter of halakha l'maaseh, that most Kohanim, unless there is a familial shtar yichus, where one can actually trace the lineage three generations back, if not more, that one does not really have the status of a Kohen Moksak nowadays, which is quite a chidush. It's quite a novel idea, because that lends itself really to a number of groundbreaking leniencies in contemporary halakha for Kohanim marrying various individuals. So we're not going to focus on earth-shattering, monumental teshuvot of that nature. Today I want to talk about something that's equally as important, but more practical, more day-to-day. So I'm going to screen share, and bear with me for one moment. Now, we have over here a famous teshuvah. And I say it's famous in the sense that this teshuvah is widely quoted among later poskim that address this issue. What's the issue? The issue over here pertains to the Anusim, the generation of Jews post the Portuguese expulsion in the late 1400s, where they're beginning to slowly come back to their tradition, to observance of mitzvot. And these people ask the Maharaj Dam a question regarding their very identity, their names. The inquirer presents the scenario as almost being taken for granted that people, these group of people had changed their names when adopting this new life of Torah observance, and they took on Jewish names. So instead of having typical Spanish or Portuguese names, they adopted names like Yaakov, like Daniel, David, etc. So what to do now when addressing family members or perhaps business partners and clients where you don't want to give off the impression that you have this peculiar name? Each person might have their own reasoning for that, right? Either it could be because there's financial gain in coming off as a neutral figure, right? If somebody doesn't assume that you are a Jew, and they probably wouldn't be doing business with you if they knew you were a Jew, that poses a financial benefit for you, right? Or it could simply be because you feel threatened. Perhaps you're dealing with clients in a region of the world where you could be put in danger if people discovered your Jewish identity. The cost of doing business, though. And that's the scenario that the Maharaj Dam is presented with. He says, where they're sending letters, in the locales where they live as Jews, the places where these other people, they have names like the names of non-Jews. Again, either because they are non-Jews, or because the Jews there simply, have assimilated, and perhaps they're not so friendly with these more observant Jews. Whether this is with regard to their friends, relatives, or if they're doing business with such people. So what's the question? Can they change or revert back to using the names which they had when they were, it's interesting. He says when they were non-Jews, right? So over here, the implication is that these conversos had actually lost their status as Jews and had converted back to Judaism, or their Mizera Israel, that their fathers were Jewish. They had a chazakah of being Jewish, but their mothers were not. At any rate, that's not the story with all conversos, as we know, right? It's a bit more complicated than that, but that's the implication over there. Alternatively, perhaps there is a problem with this. What's the problem? Because this could be giving off the impression that he doesn't identify as a Jew anymore. He identifies as a non-Jew and doesn't accept that all hamisvot, the yoke of the commandments that one accepts when they convert, and this is an abrogation of identifying as a Jew. We're going to see in a moment, Maharaj Kam is going to say, well, that's nice and all, but which Isur min HaTorah or Midrabanan does that violate? So we're going to see three different sugyot, three different topics in the Talmud that address this issue. But for now, the inquirer is assuming that there is an issue with this. I should point out, by the way, that the concept of converts adopting new names is already established by Ranban, alav shalom. Ranban in Perush to the Torah, he says Yitro is given, Moshe Rabbeinu's father-in-law is given two names, yeah? He's addressed as Yitro or Yeter, and then he's also addressed later in the Torah as Chovev. Right, why is he called Chovev? So Ramban presents this opinion among our Chachamim that Yitro had in fact joined Am Yisrael, and the practice already from the days of Moshe Rabbeinu was that if somebody joined the Jewish people, they took on a new identity and they adopted new names. So that's an interesting side point. So Maharaj Kam, I want to also point out one last thing before we begin his teshuvah, which is that he very often, Maharaj Kam very often will play devil's advocate. He'll often provide scenarios where you might have a hava amina, thought process to say X, and he rejects it and shows you why that scenario, why that train of thought is not the route that a posek or that a student should take in deciding matters of halakha. Maharaj Kam was unique in this. In other words, he was unique in not just giving you the straight answer, but actually going through his reasoning, cross-examining himself, if you will, because he also served as a Rosh HaYeshiva. He founded a yeshiva in Salonika, and it was the yeshiva that produced many hachamim in the Balkan region of the Mediterranean basin, and it was a towering yeshiva for many, many years. And so, as Rosh HaYeshiva, that is often the train of thought, the method of thinking that they deal with on a daily basis, right? Okay. So he says, Emet kimidat chasidut la kamina. Devadai midat chasidut hu la archika adam asmo bechol minei haherot she'efshar. He says, we're certainly not going to be discussing what is considered an act that is above and beyond what the halakha requires. Because if one really wants to go above and beyond, then certainly all forms of separating oneself, distancing oneself from adopting practices or other cultural norms of the goyim is praiseworthy. Ubifrat lemi she'avral rosho hamayim hazedonim. Especially with regard to somebody who had gone through these mayim hazedonim, a phrase borrowed from Tehillim in reference to the anusim who had been forcibly introduced to Catholicism. So perhaps it's appropriate for them to swing in the other direction so as to distance themselves from Catholicism. Achen minatim nireh be'enai davar barur. So Maharaj Kam says, however, according to the letter of the law, he already gives you the answer from the outset. It's obvious to me, there's not even a concern for any isur being violated here in addressing yourself by a Portuguese name or a Spanish name. And he says, even though you might provide for me some source that says that at first glance it is prohibited to do this. By the way, I'm going to read some of these passages outside, not translating word for word, just for the sake of time, right? So he says, he quotes from the Tur. In the Tur, Yordea Siman Kof Sadizayin 197, there's a case, there's a halakha that states that a person may not present themselves as a non-Jew if one fears that being in a location where one has a Jewish appearance or name, that he will be he'll be killed. So you can't do that. Or more appropriately, excuse me, one cannot overtly or explicitly say that he is a non-Jew. Why? Because if one does so, he gives off the impression that he in fact rejects HaKadosh Baruch Hu and his Torah, and he's caving in to whatever faith group or ideology that the Goyim are trying to force on other Jews. Otherwise, why would you lie and say that you're a non-Jew? And now, the one who's inquiring might say, now, you might say, based on this, this is no different. You're sending in a letter to these people that you're dealing with in business or family or whatever, and you're using a different name. So that's kind of like saying you're a non-Jew, and that's prohibited. Even if you want to say, no, come on, if somebody has a gun to your head, that's a different case. That's not the case we're dealing with here. He says there's an added element in that case. Or one is trying to save one's life in the process. And even so, to save your life, where normally you could violate the whole Torah to save your life, it's still prohibited to say you're a non-Jew. Whereas in this case, you're just changing your name so you could close on a nice business deal. Right? Oh, or for another matter, it would certainly be appropriate to say that this is forbidden, because it's not life and death. So he says, Ela shinire b'li safek she'achar iyun kol dehu yimsa ha'adam she'hadin hu she'hu mutam. Says, but this is a superficial analysis of the halakha. Even after the slightest analysis of the sources, Maharashtam says we can arrive at the conclusion that it's permitted. And he brings for you source number one, or proof number one. Proof number one is a Gemara in Nedarim. In Masechet Nedarim, the Gemara talks about how to avoid certain taxes. Now, preface to this Gemara, don't cheat on your taxes. You can't cheat on your taxes. It's not allowed. What the Gemara is talking about over here, contrary to how many people understand sugyot like this, topics like this in the Talmud, the Gemara is talking about specific, I use in air quotes, taxes that were placed on Jews alone and on no other group of people. Right, so the Talmud debates whether or not these are considered bona fide or lawful forms of taxation under the government in which a Jew lives. And it's generally assumed that if it's a tax that's placed only upon Jews and nobody else, then, you know, if you can get out of it, you can get out of it. Right, because well, there are a variety of reasons as to why, which we're not going to get into. But the Talmud says, the Gemara Nedarim says, that it's permitted, share lesubam rabana lememar avda denurana. A student of the Talmidei Chachamim, that's an important phrase to remember, subam rabana, if one is a Talmid Chachamim, a student of our sages, he is permitted to say that he is a fire worshiper. Avda denura is a fire worshiper. Does anybody want to take a guess as to which group of people this is in reference to?
Zoroastrians, perhaps?
Yeah. Yeah. So it's pretty clear beyond doubt that in the culture that the Jews of Babel had to deal with in the third and fourth and fifth centuries, that we're talking about Zoroastrians. Zoroastrians would fall under this category of those who are of the Avodah Zarah. It's not like Islam, where they believe in a supreme deity that is the source of all sources, but instead they have this notion of dualism, right? Two co-equal deities that control the world. So what does this have to do with fire? So one of the key elements in Zoroastrian worship is the fire. In what capacity? I don't know. I'm not an expert in Zoroastrian rituals and rites, but it's a key element in how they worship. So the Talmud says you can say this, right? La yahidna achraga. So as to prevent me, so that I don't have to give this property tax. There was a particular property tax that was assessed and placed upon Jews in particular, and not on Zoroastrians. My Tama, so the Talmud asks the obvious question. It's like, okay, well, why is this permitted? La'avruche areyamine. This is to flee from the lion that is with him. The lion being, of course, the tax, right? Excuse me. La'avruche areyamine hu de'aman. He's saying this in order to run away from this lion. Now, we're going to skip a little bit further. And Marashtam explains, this Gemara is relevant to us. Mishum demuchach milta de la amar hachi, ela ala achture michraga. It's obvious he's not saying he's Zoroastrian because he believes that. In fact, it's not even something that remotely smells of being genuine. In the case that the Maharashtam brought up from the tour, where a person says he's a non-Jew to save his life, you can argue, well, maybe he's sincerely trying to present himself as a non-Jew because he's under duress, he's going to be killed. And it's possible that in the recesses of his mind, he says, well, you know, I'll throw the baby out with the bathwater, forget my Judaism, it's not worth being a Jew if I'm going to be killed over it. But that's not the case over here. Over here, he just doesn't want to pay a tax. And it's obvious to everybody that he doesn't want to pay a tax, and that's why he's saying this. Right? Hacha benidon didan, shehu yehudi, ve'oved Hashem, ve'eno omed, hu atzmo ve'makom she'olat sham, haketav. Says, certainly then, in our case, where this person is an observant Jew, he's not going himself to the place where the letter is going, where the non-Jews could look at him and say, oh yeah, you know what, yeah, this really is a, this guy who sent this letter in the mail, he's definitely a non-Jew. It's being carried by a mail carrier. It's merely a matter of doing this so that, as I said earlier, so that the goyim who are carrying this or the goy who receives this does not charge the individual the property tax that the Talmud was talking about, right? And it's permitted, even though they can't tell who this person is. Mi huzeve ezeku, like to borrow the phrase from Megillat Esther. It's like casting an anonymous ballot in a way, where you're anonymous insofar as you're just another name. It's like, yeah, your name might be on the piece of paper, but your name is as relevant as are the hundreds of thousands, if not millions, of other letters that are being carried in the mail. So, I'm going to skip again a little further. So he says, Peshita Vadai Demutar. It's obvious and it's certainly permitted. Actually, no, sorry, I'm going to skip this too. This is a slight tangent that Maharashtam takes, not really relevant. Now, here we go. Now Maharashtam is going to play devil's advocate again. He says, he says, even though there are those rabbinical authorities that interpret the passage that we read in a different way, they say, Dafka lesulbad rabbanan hetirukem. The Chachamim only permitted one to play low-key, to appear as a non-Jew on in writing, only for somebody who's a student of the Talmidei Chachamim. Uchmo shekatav harosh zad. Rabbeinu Asher, in his commentary over in Masechet Nedarim, he says that it's specific to this demographic of Jews who are permitted to do this. Why? We're not concerned that the Talmid Chachamim is going to glorify himself in his identity of being the non-Jew, thereby belittling his Jewish identity. They're doing this for a specific purpose with a specific agenda, and it's not going to go anywhere else beyond that. This is in reference to the Nimukei Yosef, another commentary on the Talmud. He gives an alternative approach to that of Rabbeinu Asher that we just read. The Fishasulbad Rabbanan Yodim Lichaven. In the singular, he's able to have genuine and sincere intention when doing so. That he is the true fire, right? It's not, that's a pun on the Zoroastrian form of worship. It's not the fire of the Zoroastrians that has any power. He knows what he's doing. Whereas for another person, you know, perhaps they will be misled into this and misled by seeing benefits and associating with Ovdei Avodah Zarah, with foreign forms of worship. And it could be a slippery slope because you may say, look at this. I get a tax break by associating with them. I go to the Christmas party and, you know, everybody likes me when I go there. Great benefits. It's a slippery slope. So perhaps it's only permitted for students of Talmidei Chachamim to write such names in their letters. He says, Maharashtam says, let's not jump to conclusions though. Mikol makom benidon didan, in our case at hand, so not the case of the Talmud that was talking about the property tax rate, but in our case where you're sending letters in the mail addressing yourself as, by a different name, by a different Portuguese name or Spanish name. You cannot make a distinction between a rabbinical scholar, right, a student of the Talmidei Chachamim, or between any other person. It's true. Rabbeinu Asher is correct, he says, or he could be correct in that only in that specific case that the Talmud was talking about could it lead to such an individual taking advantage of his identification as a non-Jew, thereby belittling his Jewish identity. So in that case, you should be surbad rabbanan to engage in that further. Why is the case of the Talmud there different? Because it's possible that the government is equally as invested in receiving their taxes as you are in avoiding them. Okay, and anyone who's dealt with the IRS here in the US knows that very well. So it's very, very possible that You say you're a Zoroastrian? Let's audit you. And they may audit you. They might come and audit him verbally. And that might lead such a person to say further things that are unbecoming of a Jew and perhaps even prohibited things. So as to not come off as a charlatan. He's got to prove himself to be a good religious Zoroastrian. So maybe he'll do things that are idolatrous. Who knows? Whereas the Talmid Chachamim, again, this is Maharashtam's thesis over here. You can argue if this reality holds true in all times and places. But he says that's not true for a real Talmid Chachamim. Why? Shim yavo le'ado kach, because if he in fact gets audited by these Babylonian tax auditors, kach yafsid amas, because if that's the case, so he simply loses the tax. He pays it, goes about his way, and he won't feel the need to justify himself further. Why? Because that's not what Surva de Rabbanan do. Maharashtam is making a fascinating claim here. He's saying the Ameha Aris, regular everyday laymen that are relatively assimilated, don't have the need to justify themselves at the penalty of monetary fine or taxation to be Jews. If there's a game for them, they'll play the game of the goyim. Whereas Talmidei Chachamim, the opposite, with Talmidei Chachamim, the opposite notion exists. They're not living in Bavel in order to justify themselves to the goyim there. They live there because that's where the Jewish community primarily resided, where the major yeshivot in the days of the Amoraim existed. And that's really essentially the only reason why they were there. But they're not there to justify themselves to the culture. So if it comes down to it, they'll admit they're a Jew, pay the fine, and move on. Mashe ben don didan la shayach. Whereas in the case at hand over here, where you're writing to relatives or business partners, this concern does not exist. Keva she'eno ela ketab echad be'alma shaluch emachut acher peshita deleka lenegzah. It's one letter being sent to a different kingdom where they don't even have jurisdiction over you. What's the worst that can happen? The government official, or the business partner or the relative finds out that you're really, a religious Jew, an observant Jew. Okay, and then what? Is there a concern that you're gonna have to justify yourself? Probably not. There's no penalty. You don't lose anything. So we're not going to go ahead and decree that this is a prohibited act because of that. We only address the Rosh's concern. He says, all the more so according to the Nimukei Yosef's concern, where he says there is no difference between being a Talmid Chacham or another person. Okay. Last point he says, Kal v'chomer, all the more so according to the opinion of Rabbeinu Nissim. Rabbeinu Nissim says that the Talmud used the wordage of Surva de Rabbanan. A student of the rabbis is permitted to say he's a fire worshiper in that case. He says, that was a haphazard choice, if you will. It was only by example. The Talmud was using that phrase as an example, but lav dafka, it's not specifically a heter, a permissive decree to be utilized only by students of the Talmidei Chachamim. Really, this applies to anybody. Now, I'm going to do the rest outside. The Marashdam provides another very powerful proof for why it's permitted to use non-Jewish names in the scenario that we are discussing, based on a fascinating discussion in the Talmud regarding Jewish clothing and non-Jewish clothing. Okay, this is, by the way, all of this, in case I didn't say it earlier, is relevant to us. I chose this topic in particular, not only because it's practical and relevant, but because of Hanukkah. The Hashmonaim had, as we know, like many Jews during the Hasmonean period, had Greek names. Yohanan Herkinos, right? And many other such names. The Gemara gives one example that was used during that period of the name Locus. That was a common name among, not such a frequent name that was used among Jews, but even names like that were used by Jews, assimilating into the culture. So the example given now by the Maharashtam pertains to wearing shatnez. So the Talmud talks about, the Talmud in Masechet Bava Kamma talks about a person who wants to avoid a similar tax. Again, it's not a fair tax. It's a tax that only penalizes Jews for being Jewish, okay? And this individual thinks he can get out of it by wearing shatnez. You wear wool and linen together, there's no way they're going to suspect you of being a Jew. So, there's a machloket in the Talmud as to whether or not that's permitted. The Talmud ends up deciding, ends up concluding, no, it's not permitted to do that. So, here we go. So the Maharashtam says, why is it prohibited to do that? He says, Elahatam davka shelevusho mochiyah halav she'eno yehudi me'ahashu lovesh ha'isur la'yehudim. He says, that's different because it's true. The clothing that you are wearing is prohibited to wear. Why is it prohibited for you to wear that? Not because there's something inherently wrong with it in presenting you as a non-Jew. It's only presenting you as a non-Jew because the item itself is prohibited for you to wear. Right? So here, the Maharashtam, he's really referencing to Teshuvah of Rabbi Yosef Kolon. I'm not going through the whole thing right now, but basically there are two categories of clothing which we're forbidden from wearing under halacha, according to Maharashtam. One category falls under the category being described here, under the type of clothing being described here, which are clothing made of fabrics or materials that are prohibited under halacha, such as kilayim, such as shatnez. Alternatively, if the material is all kosher, right, he's wearing, let's say an individual is wearing something that's pure cotton or pure wool or pure polyester, whatever the case may be. If the clothing is something that is inherently non-Jewish, that also poses a problem. So the example that Rabbi Yosef Kolon provides includes religious garbs of goyim. If you were to wear a bishop's cloak, a gown, or if you were to wear other forms of clothing that specifically identify you with the rites or with the rituals of foreign worship, then this would be prohibited. But if you're wearing clothing that happens to be worn by a great variety of other people, such as, you know, a button-down shirt, or a jacket, or a t-shirt. These are quote-unquote neutral. These are neutral clothing. They're not clothing which would constitute a prohibition of chukat nochri, following in the ways of, in the rites of non-Jews. Od hevi ra'aya aferet. The Maharik, which Maharashtam is endorsing, brings another proof which he wants to use to support using non-Jewish names. He says, that the Gemara in Sanhedrin talks about a case where the Goyim decree upon Jews to change certain behaviors. And the Talmud says, even if it's arketa de mesana, even if it's a shoelace where Jews use color X, I believe the Talmud's example is black shoelaces, and the Goyim say, no, change it to red. Asur. It's a shoelace. What's the big deal? Marashdam says, Haynu dafka shagoyim omrim ase kaf kadeh lechalel Hashem. If Goyim enact the Shema, any form of government-sanctioned persecution against Am Yisrael, in order to belittle our Torah, or belittle the image or name of Borei Olam, then that's a problem. It doesn't matter what the decree is. It doesn't have to necessarily be a violation of halakha. Changing your shoelace is not a violation of halakha. But it is a change in the customs and norms that Am Yisrael had adopted in those days. The fashion norms. Fashion norms are not a matter of halakha. But if it reduces you as a people and belittles you as a people, over there we say the Jews caving in constitutes a chilul Hashem, that's prohibited. Az hudasu. Then it's prohibited. Aval kedei shelo yeh nikar shehu yehudi. But if one wants to go about in a manner where it's not obvious that he is a Jew, kigon lilvosh bigdei nochri, o lihitnayeg bidvarim shelo yeh nikar, whereas one is wearing, as I said earlier, clothing that non-Jews also wear, so that it's not so apparent that he's a Jew, so that's permitted. He says, or alternatively, if one wants to avoid this tax that's only imposed on Jews. That's why the Talmud says you can't wear kilayim. You can't wear shatnez, which is a biblical prohibition. We're not going to let you violate the Torah just so you can get a tax break. But if you're doing something that's permitted and you just happen to play anonymous in the process, there's no violation in doing this. I can go further, but I don't want to, because I also want to save time for the teshuvah of Mahari Berab. Maharashtam ends up concluding basically along the lines that we have just discussed. And it's a fascinating teshuvah that addresses issues that Jews were now facing in the era, in the 16th century, during an era where they are no longer conversos. They're no longer in hiding. They're no longer being persecuted to the extent, at least, that they were in the 15th century and 14th century. And so I want to move on, though, to the next teshuvah. But are there any questions before I move on to this? Okay. All right. So, Mahari Berab, very briefly, he was, Mahari Berab was actually from the period of the Gerush. He was born in Castile, if I recall correctly. And during the expulsion, after the expulsion, he had made his way to a number of different regions in North Africa, ultimately settling in Eretz Yisrael, in Sefat, towards the latter years of his life. He's famous for being the Rav HaMuvak, the primary teacher and chacham of Rabbi Yosef Karo and other very prominent Talmidei Chachamim who lived in the 16th century in Eretz Yisrael. Other chachamim who were musmachim of his, in the proposed reinstitution of Semicha that he tried to reinstitute, there were a number of students who had the zechut, who had the merit of receiving this new Semicha from him. One of those, famously, of course, was Maran. The other was Rabbi Moshe Mitterani, who himself says that he was Zoche to have this semicha from him. He writes this in his work, Kiryat Sefer. And then the other students are a matter of debate. Some say Rabbi Moshe Kol Debero, the famous Mekuval. Others also include Rabbi Israel de Kuriel, a very, very prominent Darshan from the period. At any rate, I picked a very simple but significant teshuvah. Most of the teshuvot in Mahari Berab deal with matters of Evin Ha'ezer and Hoshen Mishpat. They deal with matters of divorce, of marriage, of inheritance, and other such issues. So this is a simple question. Hay surba min abanan, denach nafshe b'chus la'aretz. The Talmid Chacham passed away in the diaspora. V'la pakid l'ha'alo tol le'eretz Yisrael. And he never instructed in his will as to where he ought to be buried in particular. He didn't say to be buried in Eretz Yisrael. He also didn't explicitly, the implication is what, he also didn't explicitly say that he wants to be buried in Damascus or in Constantinople, right? It's not explicit. Is it proper to bring his body to Eretz Yisrael to be buried or not? Because he did not leave in his will a direction, it appears this is not what he had held to be buried in Israel. And if this isn't what he wanted, then he wouldn't be doing this for him. That which he did not want. So, really the question is a non-starter, right? Because if he didn't instruct anybody as to where he wants to be buried, then how do you have permission to bury him in Chutz La'aretz either? He has to be buried somewhere. But no matter how you approach this, the argument can be made that he can't be buried in Israel because he never said to do that. Well, he also never said to be buried in Chutz La'aretz, right? So you can use the same argument there. So this leaves us in a bit of a limbo. If something is not explicit in the will, then how do we address this issue, at least with regard to the issue of the location of burial? This issue of wills and trusts in halakha obviously differs in matters pertaining to dividing assets and issues of the Bechora and other related issues. But here we're not dealing with any of that. Here we're simply dealing with burial plot. So, Ma'ari Berab says, first off, you have to know. There are many instances where the phrase, Dilma Malach HaMavet Anse, that phrase where the angel of death may have coerced the person, meaning death got a hold of a person at a time when it was least expected. And unfortunately, not everybody he did not have time to instruct a will to him, meaning to his students, or to his children for that matter. There is also an additional factor. Here is something significant where Ma'ari Berab is, I'm not going to say he's the first, but he's one of the first from the generation of the post-Gerush Hachamim, post-expulsion Hachamim from Spain, who invoked the Zohar as a matter of concern in the question. So he quotes a passage from the Zohar from Parashat Vayechi, where here the Zohar deals with the following. I demit mechus la'aretz, he who passes away in the diaspora, u'ma'alin oto le'eretz Yisrael, and only after he passes away do they bring him to Israel to be buried, but he never lived there. Alav HaKatuv v'omer, about him, the pasuk in Yirmiyah says, v'atavo v'atitame'u et arsi. Behold, they have come here to Eretz Yisrael, and they have defiled my land. It's a very, very harsh statement. And one can understand where this is coming from, right? You choose your whole life, or perhaps you didn't choose, but for one reason or another, you did not live in Eretz Yisrael during your lifetime. You didn't have the opportunity, either willfully or against your will, to fulfill the mitzvah of Yishuv Eretz Yisrael. And only now, once you pass away, you have the time to be buried there? That's inappropriate. V'im kol zeh, כיוון שרוב החכמים והצדיקים ורובה דעלמא מתאבים שיעלו עצמותיהם לארץ ישראל. This is a very interesting factor that Maharib Rab is invoking. He says, among the demographic of Talmidei Chachamim, righteous individuals, even ruba de'alma, most, literally most of the world, but he's referring to most Jews, mit'avim she'yalu asmotehem le'eretz Yisrael. They yearn for this. It's a Jew's dream. He says, therefore, excuse me, anan sahadeh, we may bear witness de'ni halela usubat merabanan de'nachnav she'bechus la'aretz she'yalu asmotehem le'eretz Yisrael. Anan sahadeh, by the way, it's a canon in halacha. It's a canon in halacha that basically substitutes full-blown testimony. For example, the Talmud gives a famous case of Shechiv Mera, a person who was bedridden, is about to pass away, and he gives all of his assets away to a particular entity, a charity or whatever the case is. And the doctor comes to him the next day or within the hour and says, you know what? Sir, ma'am, you're actually fine. You're going to be cured. Be'ezrat Hashem, you'll be fine. Nothing's wrong with you. You don't have to worry anymore. So there, in similar cases where it's obvious, right? It's abundantly obvious beyond the shadow of a doubt that you only committed an action because of the circumstances and you were mistaken about the reality. You were mistaken about the facts. Then you can undo the action, so to speak. So similarly over here, Mahari Berab is saying, it's abundantly clear and obvious that he would want to be buried in Eretz Yisrael. Yes, it's not explicit in the will. Yes, we can't determine explicitly one way or the other what he would have decided. But this is what most people in his position would want. Ma'ari Berab even goes a step further. But I forgot to address one thing. The passage from the Zohar that he invokes that seems to be against people living their whole lives in Israel and being buried only in Israel is not addressed. That's because Ma'ari Berab only quotes the Zohar in part. So the rest of that passage in the Zohar actually reads a little differently. The Zohar says, didn't Yaakov Avinu live most of his life outside of Eretz Yisrael? He passed away in Mitzrayim, and they had a whole big procession where he was brought back to Eretz Canaan, and only then was he buried in Ahuzat Avotav, in the plot of his forefathers, Me'arat HaMachpelah, and that also seems inappropriate then, yeah? So the Zohar says, no, that's different, because the Shekhinah resides with Talmidei Chachamim, especially with Yaakov Avinu Alav Shalom, where the Torah tells us, Anochi Ered Necha Gamalo, I will go down with you to Mitzrayim and I will also return with you. So, it's not explicit in Mahari Berab's language, but I'm assuming he's applying the same reasoning to all Talmidei Chachamim who live primarily outside of Israel and wants to be buried in Eretz Yisrael, that this would be, the concern of the Zohar would not be a concern for that reason. So now you might say, well, he still never mentioned it in his will. You can't just go ahead and do drastic things to the niftar, to the deceased individual, without clear instructions. So Mahari Berab says, that's not a concern, because it's quite common actually that he may not have instructed in his will what to do. Mishum detakif le'alma, because he had passed away so suddenly. Or mishum shelar asal akriach levanav, or because he felt bad. He felt bad. He didn't want to bother his children with the very, very difficult and laborious task, an expensive task of bringing the body from God knows where in Husares. Again, keep in mind, we're talking the early 1500s here. It wasn't a simple matter, a simple task to transport a body in good faith and in good condition to Eretz Yisrael. So maybe that's why he didn't do it. But deep down, he did want it, probably. Behine Bizman is a typo over here. Quick history lesson in what happens when you're transcribing something from manuscript into print. It says over here, Behine Bizman HaNazir. It should be Nagid. Gimel and Zayin can be confusing at times. Resh and Dalet can be confusing at times. Behine Bizman HaNagid, Tavod Morenu Rizhak Cholem. He was the Nagid, the president of the community in Egypt during the lifetime of Mahari Berak. Biyoto b'Misrayim. When he was in Egypt, Asanu Natanu b'Davar. We were deliberating a similar matter. Mipinei she'anichbar kvod Moreinu Rabbi Natan Shelel. Rabbi Natan, he may have been a relative of Rabbi Yitzchak. I'm not entirely sure, to be honest. Lo siva she'ya'alu oto le'Eretz Yisrael. He also never explicitly said so, to bring his body up to Eretz Yisrael. He never wrote that in his will. And our conclusion was she'ya'alu oto, to bring him and have him buried there. And that's what was done. And they brought him up to Eretz Yisrael to be buried. Alken, hale alecha, I beg you, he's saying to his student who asked him this question, she'tikdov li ve'orech, please write to me about how the events transpire in light of what I have told you. This is a personal touch to Sefaradi Chachamim, by the way. The personal touch of not only dealing with your student, with the inquirer, in a matter-of-fact way, like you're just another number in the many list of questions that I receive, but in fact, you care for the outcome of the case. Please keep me updated. I want to know what happens to the body. He who is readily there for your honor, Yaakov. So, again, fascinating teshuvah, very brief. We see for the first time, one of the first times where post-Gerush Chachamim begin to invoke the Zohar in matters of halacha. We see a case where the canon of Anan Sahadeh, de facto testimony is invoked in this particular case. And we also see something very interesting where the president of the community, not the Chacham, but the president, is also included in the discussion of halakha. He has a say in the matter because this is a communal matter. It sets precedent. How do we address this issue for generations to come? Again, all of these factors and the factors which the Maharashtam had included in his Teshuvah, from this we see how holistically, how comprehensively our Chachamim dealt with issues, as opposed to quoting a source or two and performing all sorts of pilpul on this one source or these two sources to arrive at a preset conclusion. Our Chachamim didn't have preset conclusions. They arrived at the Maskana through careful and considerate deliberation, and always with the intent of helping those who were in need. I leave off here for today, but of course, I'm available to take any questions, if anyone has any questions.
Thank you so much, Chacham. And if anyone has any questions or comments, they can unmute, raise their hands. I'll start off with in the first teshuvah.
Yes.
If I understood correctly, did he accept the kal v'chomer that was drawn about if you can't do it in a situation where you're going to be killed, then kal v'chomer in a situation of by money?
Meaning that initial... No. Sorry, continue.
No.
He rejects that. Marashdam rejects that, and he says the two cases are not analogous. Why are they not analogous? Because in the case where you're forbidden from presenting yourself as a goy at the penalty of being killed, that case constitutes a chilul Hashem. The case of changing the color of your shoelace even. That's one of the categories where the Talmud in Masechet Sanhedrin sets a clear red line, a line in the sand. Yehereg v'al yavor. A person in theory, I say in theory because it's always easier said than done, but in theory you ought to give up your life than to be mechalel shem shamayim. Whereas in the case of you identifying as a ploni almoni, the non-Jew, in a letter, or you know, in other similar situations, there's no chilul Hashem presented because they have no idea who you are. You're just another name. You're just another person among tens of thousands of other letters.
But what about if it's not anonymous? Let's say you actually do want to integrate into their society, but it's not a shat tashmad, meaning it's not under the penalty. There's no chilul Hashem.
He also addressed that. He said, I can find it for you, but he addressed the factor of being, of dressing in their clothing, but not clothing that's meyuchad lahem, right? If you're going to dress like them for the purposes of just doing so because you like the clothing, here we go. I found it. Me'achar shehu lovesh, 1 second. I'm sorry, I thought that was it, actually. I'll try to find it for you again. But he says that if it's something which is a practice that goyim happen to practice, like wearing clothing that they happen to wear, or like having names that they happen to have, but it's not something which is only specific to them. And actually, this is a part where I skipped. I didn't read it inside. But he says if they can point to you and say, ah, that's a goy. So that would be prohibited. But if you happen to be doing things where you're simply blending in, here, this is the line. Kegon bilbosh bigdei nochri, o lihitnaeg bidvarim shelo yenikar, specifically so that you're not apparently Jewish, but you're also not apparently non-Jewish, right? You're blending in. That's muta. O kedei la'avon hameches, or even if you're doing so for financial gain, that's also permitted. There's no chilul Hashem constituted in doing this.
Right.
Right.
Mm-hmm. Avi?
Thank you for that. It was really fascinating. My question is a little bit broader, but and it could be because we skipped that it might address it had we gone like completely fully, but...
Sure, sure.
What I notice is when the question is not necessarily bringing in a sort of a halachic baseline, or when he's doing the sort of hava amina for them, like afal gav, right? He's not bringing in like sort of the source in Rambam or in the first teshuva, even like Shulchan Aruch. Or it seems to be going straight into the Gemara of why it might be a problem, right? There isn't a sort of, and it could be we missed it out, I don't know, but... what I've noticed is he's finding an isur from a Gemara, right? Is it the Gemara that they're quoting sort of a maskana, or is that like some thought process within the Gemara and saying, oh, it could be asur because the Gemara says this somewhere? Because I find that a bit more difficult. It's sometimes easier when you have like a, you know, Rambam says this, clearly it's asur, yeah. And that's the conclusion of the sugya. Than to find problems and, you know, from a random shakla vetaria in the middle of a sugya.
I'm happy you brought this up. So this goes back to one of the points I brought up in my introduction about Maharashtam, which was his way of writing. This is part of why he's not widely learned by everybody. His way of writing and the way he deals with matters of halakha. And also in his derashot, he has a whole book of derashot Ben Shmuel. It's very difficult to follow because he was constantly immersed in the world of Shakla v'Tariya, the back and forth of the Talmud. He was a Rosh HaYeshiva. That's how they thought. But by the same token, he does revert back to established baselines, right? For example, the standard he gives for what constitutes Chukat Nochri. He used the Teshubah of Rabbi Yosef Kolon. That's my baseline. Why doesn't he quote Rambam or Shulchan Aruch? It's odd for him not to quote Rambam, actually. Quite often he does. He doesn't seem to over here. But he doesn't quote Shulchan Aruch because he was a contemporary of Maram. So, I mean, the Shulchan Aruch was published in his days already, but he doesn't frequently quote Shulchan Aruch. In fact, when he does, he usually, in the rare instances where he quotes Maran, he quotes his Bet Yosef. But that's only in passing, right? He doesn't feel bound by Maran because he was his contemporary. So, I hope that addresses the question.
Thank you.
It's kind of odd because we're used to seeing Teshuvot where Shulchan Aruch is the baseline, right? But again, here you're dealing with a different reality. We were still dealing with the primary sources, the Gemarot, the Rishonim. Yeah. All right. Any other questions?
Okay, so I think we'll end it for tonight. Thank you so much, everyone, for being here. Thank you so much, Chacham. And stay tuned. We'll be on next Wednesday for part two of the series. And Laila Tov, everyone. Chag Sameach.
Chanukah Sameach, everybody.